Don't mind me, man. I'm just waiting for the music.
Ah, there it is. There it
hey,
is.
There it is.
I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. That 10 seconds between the time she says 10 seconds and it's starting is long. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. And welcome to Make Me Smart, our first Make Me Smart, back from quite a long break. We're just going to hit that disclaimer right at the top.
So Molly's got a cold. I'm a little jet lagged. You know, It's all fine. Amy Scott, who you will hear later, is also just off vacation. So, you know.
She literally still has Cancun and white chocolate bread on the brain.
Right. That's right.
Okay, but this is the show where every week we get smart about all things tech, economy, and culture. And of course, we could not do that without all of you because, as we say sometimes around here, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Sometimes they make us say it every time, you know, every time.
Every time. Every time.
Today is, and Marketplace listeners will know this because we're having Amy on, today is Housing Day here at Make Me Smart. Why is it Housing Day? Well, because holy cow, that's one of the huge factors in this economy. It is a driver of wealth. It's also a driver of debt, oh, by the way, which can be a bad thing. It fuels booms and busts. There's in certain markets around this country, it is ridiculously hot. Hello, Los Angeles and San Francisco, Oakland, Bay Area. And you know, prices are becoming problematical. And you roll that in with, oh, by the way, the Fed raising interest rates and all that good stuff. And housing is a big deal right now.
It is so intrinsic and it is so intrinsic to the economy. And yes, it is possible that this topic selection is in fact influenced by, I don't know about your parties, Kai, but at every party I'm at, literally every conversation I have with everybody in the Bay Area, even like coffee shop ones, it doesn't even have to be a party because I don't know who I'm kidding about this party thing.
I don't get invited. What party?
But all we ever talk about is housing.
Seriously?
That's it. And it's kind of a nationwide phenomenon. Like nationally, housing prices have gotten out of reach for almost everyone. In fact, there's a stat from a Times article just a couple weeks ago by our good friend Neil Irwin that said nationwide personal income per capita has risen 25% since the end of 2011. But in that same period, the National Home Price Index is up 48%. And so we wondered sort of how all of this is affecting you. And as always, a listener came to our rescue to make us smart. Ashley Green Gluskin wrote to us. She and her husband live in Newton, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. This is like, this sounds like the intro to House Hunters, you know, mm-hmm. episode.
Mm-hmm.
They currently own a home and they just had their second child. And with a new addition to the family, they're feeling a bit cramped and they'd love to move.
Well, they
the problem is
one, option two or option three. I love that show.
I know, me too. I'm delighted right now. Our producer, Shara, got on the phone with Ashley, and she told us what the market is like in the burbs around Boston.
We're looking for a 3 or 4 bedroom and around 2,000 square feet, and everything is upwards of $1 million. And that's within a good train ride, so 30-minute train ride or so from downtown Boston. Absolutely crazy.
Ashley's wish list includes an open concept kitchen.
Yes, yeah, open floor plan. They would like to be near a beach. Anyway, here's the deal, though. She and her husband are a two-income family, right? She's a product manager at a tech company. So they're not making a terrible living, but they're having sticker shock as well. And they wonder if they're having it, what about other people as well? And how can other people afford to buy?
There must be some trade-offs they're making. Are they not saving for kids' college? Are they not saving for retirement? Sort of what flexibility are they doing and what options do they have to be able to afford these mortgages? So that's the question. Do we not save as much for college as we had wanted to for our children? And at this point, we haven't decided on what makes the most sense. I think the first thing that would probably give would potentially be college, which is really upsetting to me because I was very lucky and my parents helped pay for college. And I think that set me up to be in a better place. And I would love to be able to do that for my kids, but I also want to see my kids. And if I want to see them, then I need to be close to my job so that I can come home and be with them in evenings.
So Ashley and her husband have started wondering, she told us, if buying is overrated altogether, a conversation I have with myself all the time. They looked at renting again, but rental prices are higher, she found, in that area than a monthly mortgage. And then, of course, there's the thing where you don't own a house. Your landlord might sell it and you might get kicked out, or you can't, you know, knock down a wall and build your open concept kitchen. for example. And then, of course, they want an extra room. Now we're back in House Hunters because Ashley's husband works from home. And this all has her feeling like her family is really stuck.
I definitely feel stuck, which is crazy because we already own a house. How can you feel stuck when I'm in a very nice town with a good school system, but prices keep increasing and I can't go anywhere? And as I see new houses being built or houses being purchased in my neighborhood, I'm just questioning, is it sustainable? And what if the market crashes? What's going to happen to these houses? Are we just going back to 2008 again? And I understand we live in Boston and it's expensive, but this isn't just happening in Boston. This is happening in all the major cities.
Which is why we have Amy Scott on the phone. Amy, and it's actually interesting that Ashley was talking about college, right? Because Amy was for many years our higher education correspondent, and now she's doing housing for us. So we got her on the phone,
That's right.
I think it's really fortuitous, actually.
I moved from one source of debt to another.
I know. Ms. Scott, welcome to the podcast, by the way.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
So let's talk, first of all, about how normal this is, this feeling that Ashley's having.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this idea of being kind of stuck in your starter home is pretty common. You know, my editor, Betsy Streisand, referred to it as kind of a tiny violin story in one way, because these are people who own homes. And when I put a question out on Twitter about, you know, looking for folks who are feeling stuck, some people said, you know, oh, these poor homeowners, they can't afford to move up when we can't even afford our first home. And Ashley sort of acknowledged that. But I think it's really, really a common situation for people who maybe bought at the wrong time and had more house than they could afford. Have not benefited from rising prices. People who had a really low interest rate and now are looking at interest rates going up and they're kind of stuck with their cheap mortgage. Or people who just watch housing prices go so far up that they can't really afford to move up the way they might have wanted to.
Let's sort of broaden out a little bit to the market overall and hear an overall diagnosis. I mean, sometimes it feels like you hear these economic indicators that are supposedly really terrible, but as a consumer, you're thinking, but that sounds great. I'm thinking of like oil prices are really low, and so gas prices are low, and they're like, oh, that's terrible for the global economy. And I'm thinking, but I don't know. I like it. And that's how I feel when I hear that housing prices may be on the decline. But what does that mean for the broader economy? Why is it, you know, not good for me?
Right. Well, it's good for people who aren't in the market who want to be, certainly. And housing prices, although in some markets like the Bay Area and Seattle, housing prices have fallen in recent months, actually, they're still going up most places, just at a slower pace. But the good news about that is for people who want to buy a home and haven't been able to afford one is that maybe they can save up enough to get into the market. For the economy, I've been thinking about this a lot because, you know, the last expansion was really housing driven, the expansion before the big housing bust. You know, not only from home construction, we were building so many homes, a lot more than it turned out we needed. And so that was employing a lot of people. It was part of what was driving the economy, but also the mortgage lending and the cash out refinancing, people treating their homes as ATMs, you know, taking money out of their homes and spending it. That was a big part of what fueled the economic boom and then, of course, the bust. This time around, it's pretty different. People just aren't doing that as much. We've built up record amounts of home equity and we're not taking it out as much as you might expect. Construction has actually been really muted and that's part of the affordability story. There just aren't enough houses available. If the housing market were to turn from kind of a softening into an outright decline, the folks I've talked to have said we would not see the same kind of catastrophe that we saw last time around.
How much of that, though, not to get too far in the weeds, Amy, right? But how much of that is the fact that last time's housing crash brought with it a crash in securitized mortgages and all that jazz, right? And so there's a layer of this that is not just housing market dependent, but also financial institutions and what they're doing with the housing market dependent, right?
Yeah, that's true. A lot of that has changed. The risky lending, the risky securitization of right. those loans, all of that has changed. And so it's just not as fundamental a risk right. to the economy as it was.
And we should say here, that's, you know, securitization is a fancy way to say mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations and all of that, that really tricky financing that led yeah. to the housing collapse dragging down the rest of the financial sector, which did very bad things to the economy. So I guess a secondary question actually is are we still scarred by that, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went to a first-time home buyers class recently here in Denver and talked to a young woman, a millennial, who was thinking about getting into the housing market, but her father lost his job during the financial crisis, and they really struggled to hold on to their house. So she was just being incredibly smart about it, making sure they had enough money for a significant down payment. She wasn't even thinking about buying a starter home. She was seeing it as the home she would be in forever. And I was just kind of stunned by that wisdom wow. that I guess came from really hard lessons. And so, yeah, I think people are being more cautious. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we know how we as a society can forget. And so I think people are nervous about the slowing of the housing market because they remember, those memories are so fresh.
Mm-hmm. Sort of post crash, why did prices get so high all over the country? Like just sort of fundamentally, what happened to the supply?
Yeah, so part of it is supply and demand, right? There, after the construction calamity, when we had a glut of available homes and prices were driven down, people stopped building. Construction costs have gone up, labor costs have gone up. So the construction of homes has just really slowed. That makes the available homes more expensive. People can charge more for them. And also, you've got people like me, Generation X and baby boomers, staying in their homes longer. So there are fewer of those existing homes available for the newcomers into the market. That's really pushed prices up. Also, we have a booming economy. You know, unemployment is at a near 50-year low. People who have jobs are wealthier, and so they're able to spend a little bit more. And I think all of those factors have contributed to the increase in prices over the last about 6 years.
So when the housing market cools, because it will,
right.
that's just the way things happen.
Mm-hmm. Slash is. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. What's going to happen? What should we be looking for?
Oh, I don't know.
All right, thanks for coming.
Yeah, see you later. So I think, for one thing, a lot of the people I'm talking to are not expecting it to cool soon. They expect it to moderate to maybe a more healthy market, you know, as interest rates become more normal at around 5%. The average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is right now about 4.8%, 4.9%. Home prices will just appreciate more slowly. Mm-hmm. And so maybe 4 or 5% a year instead of 6 or 7% a year. That said, if there is an all-out downturn, I mean, it's going to hurt. You know, people's wealth depends a lot. Those who own homes depends a lot on their home values. So they may not have as much money to spend. They may have a harder time making their mortgage payments. You know, we may see foreclosures go up again. I think what's comforting is that it's just probably going to be a softer landing. And housing itself probably won't be what causes the recession. Whereas, you know, as we discussed, that's what happened the last time around. It was really a financial crisis precipitated by a housing crisis.
So do you think if things do normalize, And would it be helpful for us to stop talking about the last recession as a housing crash when, as Kai pointed out and you pointed out, it really was a financial institution kind of driven crash? Like, I guess, you know, there's this tendency to believe that the housing market is the economy and vice versa. And if things just normalized and like some people rented and some people bought and it was somewhat affordable, you know, would we get a better view on what really is the economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the new crisis for a lot of people is an affordability crisis. Which is, it affects people's individual financial health, even if it's not a huge factor in the overall economy. So I was looking into the numbers, and housing historically has made up about 15 to 18% of GDP, you know, which isn't that much compared to like the 70% that comes from the consumer. Now, of course, there are all sorts of secondary effects, like, you know, when people have more equity in their homes, they feel richer. They can maybe take some of the equity out to buy things. You know, all the stuff we buy when we buy homes, furniture, appliances, lawnmowers. You know, that's that was my first purchase after buying a home. That stuff matters, right? But it's just a relatively a smaller piece of the puzzle. But when it comes to affordability, you know, not just home prices, but rents. More than half of people now who rent are paying more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. And that means they have less left to save up to buy a house, say, or to pay for their kids' college, or just to buy the stuff we were talking about. They have less savings in the event of a downturn. So I think you can't really separate affordability from the overall economic health of the country.
Yeah, I was about to ask a question about home ownership rates, but then it occurs to me that we always talk about housing in this economy as an ownership thing, home ownership thing. But you rightly point out that rents are high and rising, and everybody's got to have a place to live. And so just because you don't own a home doesn't mean you're not hit by housing one way or the other.
That's right. There are some benefits to renting, though, Molly. You were talking about this. You know, renters are more mobile. There have been studies that have shown that people who rent are less affected by unemployment and they're unemployed for less time because they're more portable. And for a lot of younger people, you know, I say it's okay to wait. You know, it really depends on how you're able to save otherwise. The fact is, though, that home ownership is the primary driver of wealth in our society. Maybe that's not a good thing, but it's the way that most families have wealth that they can pass on to their kids, that can help them pay for their retirement. And so when fewer people are able to buy homes, it does have a negative effect, you know, in terms of that wealth building.
I mean, is there any other vehicle? I guess that just becomes the question. Or like,
well, the stock market.
Somehow that feels worse.
Wealthy people make more of their wealth by investing in the markets. Right. But for the average family, you know, middle income family, home ownership is really the way. And I think that's a question for our society is, you know, can we find other ways to do that? Part of the problem is if you're depending on home price appreciation for your wealth and things go south, you know, there goes your equity.
Right, which was such a huge part of what happened in the crisis, right?
Exactly.
So many people lost their equity, and there was, you know, jingle mail, people dropping off their keys in the mailbox on the way out of walking out of a foreclosed home. I mean, all of that stuff.
I've never heard that term, jingle mail.
Oh, yeah. Like put your keys in an envelope.
I mean, I don't like
drop it in the mail on the way out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amy Scott does housing for us. Used to do education. That was a, you know, 10-minute primer on the American housing market, which was awesome. Thanks, Amy.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Cool.
Take care.
And that is the deep sigh that says, it's complicated.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. That's right.
It's complicated. Remember, this conversation continues in our Facebook group. I know that it is a hot topic because, as we said, it's pretty fundamental. We all ideally have to live somewhere. Type in Make Me Smart Podcast in the Facebook search box. You will find some fascinating threads. Join one of them. In fact, last week's guest, John Keegan, joined the Facebook group.
I'm sure he did that just to mess with us. Just to say, what more can I get out of their social media profiles?
Yeah. Give me more. Give me more data. That's Make Me Smart Podcast. You can find it on Facebook if you are still doing Facebook. And if you're not, I totally understand. We're going to take a little break.
But I'm also not judging you at all.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, what fixes we may have, what fixations we may have. Susan in Alta, California, wrote to tell us she believes Marketplace is an important source of business news and that she trusts our hosts and reporters to be clear and objective. She's also a Marketplace investor. To join her in keeping public service journalism strong, donate online at marketplace.org. Thanks to Susan and everyone who makes our work possible.
We're back. And I got nothing for a fix. I got nothing.
You know, poor Kai.
You know why?
He's all jet lagged.
I am jet lagged, right?
Did you do this terribly,
but I unplugged. Oh, yeah.
I did.
And you know what was really interesting, actually? So this is what I'm going to talk about. So I was off to, I didn't delete the Twitter app just because I didn't, okay, this is going to sound ridiculous and you will mock me, but here it is. I didn't delete the Twitter app from my phone because I didn't want to deal with the whole rearranged icons thing and not knowing where anything was.
Oh.
You know?
Okay.
All right. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I had some discipline and I didn't look at it. I didn't touch it. Didn't whatever. You know what I did do though? And this is weird coming from me if you know me. I felt the need to get out there on social media a little bit. So I Instagrammed a lot. Like more than I usually
noticed.
Do. I know. I saw the likes. Thanks, yep. Yo.
Italy is awesome.
Because Italy is fun, yeah. But it was very interesting. And so I was satiated a bit by my Instagram-ing.
That's super funny, Kai, because I totally noticed that you were Instagramming more. And I was like, well, of course he is. Because you can't, because the river has to flow, right?
Just that's exactly
you put
right.
Just because you put the rock in one part of the river and dam up that feed does not mean that the water doesn't have to go around.
You
like
bet.
We have the addiction. It's a problem.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm with you. In fact, I have utterly cut off Facebook from my life yet I Instagram all the time.
Yeah.
And I am aware.
Well, that's a whole other podcast. That's a whole different thing.
It really is.
If you're off Facebook, do you have to be off Instagram? Yeah, I don't know.
Believe me, after everything that did come out, all the words that were written about Facebook while you were gone, it is an increasingly difficult justification to make. Mm-hmm. But that's not at all what I'm fixated on today. Not at all.
But it's a real, there's two. You have two here. I can see.
Oh, yeah. I didn't put those in there. I appreciate the help. But all I care about today is also a future podcast, which is that evidently Chinese scientists, no surprise, are creating CRISPR babies. They are using gene editing in the womb, it appears, according to this big MIT Technology Review exclusive that came out yesterday. So Sunday, as we're recording this. Who apparently have been using embryonic gene editing to try to create babies that are resistant. It's so weird to say. Resistant to HIV, smallpox, and cholera.
Wow.
It is an absolutely, it is a stunning development. Like, for people in this field, this is totally forbidden in Europe. It is completely against the law in the U.S. to edit the genes of babies in embryo. It is hugely controversial. It leads to this whole question about whether there will be designer babies or whether they'll create babies who have genetic structures that are passed down.
So I get that it's illegal and way ew on the morality scale, but nobody who studies this stuff can be surprised that there is a scientist out there who's trying it.
Exactly.
Right?
That's what I think. Of course it was going to happen.
I'm shocked. Shocked.
Kind of course it was going to happen in China. And
yeah, kind
of. Of course it is going to lead to designer babies.
Yep.
Like, without question.
Yep. Yep.
Anyway, it's been fascinating because one day after that story came out, then almost immediately the Chinese researcher who said that he'd created the first gene-edited babies is now facing this big investigation over whether the experiments broke Chinese laws or regulation. It's just this unfolding right now, and I'm such a nerd that I basically am like, I don't want to do anything else today except for watch this movie on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Right. So was that your thing, by the way? Because that's not what you had written down in the rundown. Okay.
Nope,
all right.
That's my thing.
Just checking.
None of that other stuff.
All right.
Pretty much just that.
Good. Well, you did. All right. So there we go. So that's us. That's what we had going on this week.
Yeah. Time to hear from you guys.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Don't we all?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we all? Josh Folb, I'm going to guess, listened to our Tim Wu episode. He sent us this voice message, which has to do with the Amazon HQ2 announcements, but also housing.
My wife and I are teachers in Arlington, Virginia.
She teaches kindergarten at the elementary school that serves the Crystal City, well, now National Landing, part of town. We have lived in Arlington for 8 years, and for the past little while, we have been trying to buy a home in this already overpriced market. Needless to say, trying to get value for our money is hard. I was at the gym my wife goes to, again in Crystal City, and as I stood in this gym, I looked around and wondered if I would be able to afford to stand there in 3 years.
So, no, number one. Number two, that whole National Landing thing, my TISC right there, that whole, you know, Amazon rebranding a semi-industrial part of Crystal City, California, or Crystal City, Virginia, as National Landing is just upsetting. But anyway, yeah, no, and that's look, this is a terrible thing to say, but that's the way it's supposed to work. That's the way it's supposed to work, right? A big employer comes to town, land gets more valuable.
Yes. Oh, God, it is working so well.
Oh, man. But that's the way it's supposed to work. And look, Josh and his wife are going to get screwed. And I don't know what to say.
And yet the governor of your state lured. I mean, that is exactly why, like you said, states and cities compete so hard for these employers because writ large, which, like global trade,
right?
You know, it lifts boats.
Which gets
but
us.
Some boats sink.
Exactly, which gets us to Paul Conigliaro, who had this question about HQ2 and Amazon and all that. Here you go. It's related.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Molly. Hi, Kai. Amazon announcing their winners for HQ2 and, I guess, HQ3 has me wondering about tax breaks and subsidies offered to businesses. How do governments decide on what to offer, and are these deals ever actually good for those communities? Thanks for making me smart.
So there are two questions in there, only one of which I know the answer to, which is the first part, which is they will do anything, right? Tax breaks, real estate abatements, all kinds of things, whatever it takes to get those however many jobs the company promises to come to town, right? Remember with Amazon, it was 50,000, oh no, wait, 25,000 split in two different cities to get all these people to come. And cities and municipalities and states were giving billions of dollars in incentives, which take many, many forms. Now, as to whether they work, I don't know. I mean, look at Foxconn in Milwaukee. Those jobs are coming in at like almost $1 million a piece, just in terms of what they're costing the state, right, for that big iPhone manufacturing plant, although they might not make iPhones. The company that makes iPhones, Foxconn up in Milwaukee, you know.
Yep. I think a producer, Stephanie Hughes, our on maternity leave tech producer, was texting me and saying, wait a second, aren't these jobs, and because she lives in New York, aren't these jobs coming in at about $75,000 per person per job?
Right.
Like that seems, you know, she's like, I want my money back. I don't know if that seems worthwhile. It's sort of, I was having this conversation actually with my family about sports stadiums and whether city funded sports stadiums ever actually pay off in economic development.
That one we know the answer to.
That they don't.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So you have to wonder, it is a hard calculation to make because it's not an easy thing to quantify, but if that is our guide, then you have to assume that at some point, if they pay off, it's over, I don't know, a century.
Yeah.
Kel McGowan, on a totally different note, is a business student. After listening to our Tim Wu episode, Kel asked over email, what types of things can someone like me do in my future business career to try to protect the notion that humans, not businesses, should be the central focus of governmental policy? Which feels like an episode.
How much time do we have? Well, so that gets back to a couple. That gets back to some stuff we did on whether capitalism's working for everybody, right? And the conversation we had with Tim about businesses being recognized by the Supreme Court as sort of personal entities, as it were, in society. I mean, that's a
That's a very large question. Yeah. But I will say we have talked about this. Just like the shortest little nugget of this is that we often talk on the show as though we are sort of helpless as consumers, but consumers are driving business trends, full stop. And millennials want to buy from socially conscious companies, and they reward companies that whose CEOs engage in political ways that they approve of. Like, I feel like the personal and the business are intrinsically, even more than they ever used to be, intertwined, and that consumers still do really have power.
Okay. Hang on to your Nellies here for a minute. So if consumers are driving businesses, then what is it that Facebook is driving 2 billion people on this planet to do every day, right? Reveal information about themselves, click on bad information. I mean, consumers, and we actually have had this conversation, right? Consumers are empowered, but consumers are also, wait a minute, because here comes the email. Consumers are also idiots.
Well, sure, right? Until they know. Like,
Everybody uses Facebook, yes. Knows.
Now we know, and now Facebook is engaged in a huge and concerted effort to try to make us not go away. So yes, the test is whether we in fact go away or not, or whether we pressure advertisers to go away, or whether we stop using it. But now is the moment when we actually find out. Because now, like, and then there's the question, there's, you know, you can say we know, but like we live in our media bubble, so we know everything. It's trickling out. There's like this trickle out effect, right?
Yeah.
And I think that this flood of information is starting to make its way into homes and into the minds of people who might be like, wait, they did what now? They're doing what? They're who? And that it takes time for these trends to develop. But I think Facebook now, finally, at long last, when you often ask if they get it.
Yeah.
I think they might be starting to get it like this week. And so the question is whether we will, and we'll see. Because if we get it, we will have the power to change it. I will. Wow. I will go all.
You're gonna die on that hill right there?
On that forever.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Time for the Make Me Smart question. Once again, look at my little cheat sheet that I have here taped on the microphone. What is something you thought you knew, but then you found out you were wrong about? It is holiday time. Oh, by the way, I mean, you know, my Christmas lights are going up this weekend. Patricia Hoffman sent us a. Yeah, they are. And it's gonna take hours. It's such a. Anyway.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well.
Will you put pictures on the Facebook group? This sounds like quite an undertaking.
I will not put pictures on the Facebook group. No, I lurk on the Facebook group. That's, you know, I mean, know. That's the price
hope
of my participation.
Eternal.
All right. Patricia Hoffman. Hope springs eternal. Yes. Patricia Hoffman sent us this very on-theme answer to the Make Me Smart question.
Watching Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was an annual tradition for me growing up. Its plot and characters were a constant in your life, one of those things you just knew without conscious thought.
The name's Yukon Cornelius, the greatest prospector in the North! This is my land!
Yukon Cornelius was a miner who helped Hermie, the dentist elf, and Rudolph, and tamed the Bumble. His penchant for licking his axe was just an odd quirk, and probably why he never found gold.
Nothing.
In 2015, I read an article that there was a deleted clip from Rudolph, which had not been aired since 1964. It changed Yukon Cornelius for me forever. He wasn't just a miner, he was a peppermint miner. It was like a new light shone on my whole childhood, and the movie was forever changed for me. I don't understand why this struck me so hard, but it's like that one clip helped make sense of your entire childhood.
Well, well, well.
I mean...
There you go.
You might think you don't learn things on this show, but you never know where you're going to learn something on this show or what you're going to learn. A peppermint miner? That's so delightfully harmless, too.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, it was a good one. Mm-hmm. It was a good one.
All right. That question again. And as you can see, tell us anything in response to this question. What is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? It could be big. It could be small. It could be peppermint mining. Send us your answer. At makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Just gonna let that go for a little while. Just gonna let it go. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostat. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday. Brand new dad, by the way, Ben Tolliday, this weekend.
Yay.
I forget, boy or girl? Girl? Boy?
Girl.
Girl? Okay. Also, Daniel Ramirez. Also,
yeah. Also, Daniel Ramirez, who is
a many-time dad. Yeah.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I said that so definitively, and now I'm not really sure if it was a girl.
You
and
did. I think it was a girl, but...
I was so certain.
We'll see if he listens to the end. That's going to be the test for everybody. Do you listen to the end?
Aww.
Bye, everybody.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.